All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show today. That's not just that. I'm not just talking that. We really do. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with playwright Oliver Mayer, and we're going to be talking about his new play, Members Only. Stick around for that interview because it's a really great play, and it's going to be a really great interview. Really looking forward to it. At the beginning of the show, actually for about two-thirds of the show, we're going to be digging into the relentless moves of the Trump-Pence regime and the consolidation of fascism. Yep, you heard it. This week is going to concentrate a major political flashpoint in the fight against the Trump-Pence fascist regime. The regime is full force stepping things up in terms of not only rallying a fascist atmosphere throughout society, but on every front, the Nazis are grouping up and moving out. In a relatively short period of time, they have pushed out their agenda and unleashed their fascist minions. Outrageous and murderous assaults against Jewish people, oppressed nationalities, women, activists, and basically anyone else who dares to speak out against the Trump-Pence regime, and the rapid-fire consolidation of their Nazi rule. These times demand an appropriate response, sisters and brothers. They demand an appropriate response from each and every one of us who see and understand the great danger for humanity. So, opening the show up, we're going to be listening to a section of the question and answer period that followed a speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. That presentation was Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution, and you can access the full speech as well as parts from the Q&A discussion that followed by going to revcom.us. And then we're going to be joined by Andy Z, one of the people who initiated the group Refuse Fascism, and he's also the spokesperson for Revolution Books. And we're going to be talking with Andy about the situation we're in today and what we need to do about it. And Andy will be talking about what has been going on over the last immediate period of time, the horrors that the Trump-Pence regime has set loose, the impact on the people, and the need for people to stand up against this now like never before. Now we're going to hear something from Bob Avakian, and Avakian's responding to the question, what would be the next step if the Trump-Pence regime consolidates power? And yes, if you tuned in last week, I also played this clip then. I'm playing it again because it's just that damn important, because there's nothing else I could bring to you that addresses the question we're facing as well as this does.
So my question is, what would be the next step if this regime consolidates power, the Trump-Pence regime?
Well, I think we're seeing, I mean, I'm not a fortune teller, I can't predict everything they do, but I think we get a good sense from what they're already doing. You know, clearly now you've got the Supreme Court, you know, where they already put another fascist on the Supreme Court to begin with, a Gorsuch guy. Now they've nominated another one so that they'll have like a, you know, and these Supreme Court nominations last people's lifetimes. So, you know, you're going to change that. So everything from a woman's right to, you know, to have an abortion, to things like gay marriage, to the giving more power to the police. I mean, you've seen what the line, you know, Trump goes to Long Island, right? Gives a talk to the police and says, don't, people complain you're that you're being brutal. Don't be so nice. When you put, I don't know if you saw this, but, you know, when you put somebody in a police car, basically smash their head against it. Don't put your hand over their head and put him in. I mean, what, so this is, you know, all these are the kind of things that are a necessary part of the way they're trying to transform the country. And basically what's happened is, like I made the point, that if you try to get rid of all this stuff, which we can sort of concentrate in the term white supremacy, for example, or male supremacy, if you try to get rid of those things within this system, you're going to tear the entire fabric of the country apart. And one of the you know, ways in which you can see that is that even the very limited and partial concessions that have been made are a big part of what has given rise to this whole fascist phenomenon of trying to basically destroy and reverse everything that's basically that's positive, even though limited, that has been achieved and been won through struggle since the end of the World War II, basically. Over the last 70 or 80 years, they're trying to get rid of all that. The Make America Great Again means make America white again. It means, the way these people look at it, you know, is that everything was fine up, you know, and America was great. It was on top of the world up until Well, there are a number of things they say. Up until black people got uppity and said that they didn't want to live in these conditions anymore, up until women said they didn't want... Do you know, this is an important thing. I mean, obviously. That it was only in the 1980s that the last state in this country, I believe it was North Carolina, actually made it so that raping your wife was not legal. In other words, up until the 1980s, there were still states in this country where a man could legally rape his wife. And this goes back through the whole history of the country. So think about that for a minute. You know, that just sort of captures something in a very, you know, dramatic way. But, you know, the whole thing, women, you know, could not have bank accounts separately from their husbands. All this kind of stuff was what was brought under, you know, fire and struggled against coming off and out of World War II and through the 60s in particular. And, you know, and the whole gay phenomenon, I mean, think about that. You know, all these people who, you know, they look around and, you know, what the hell's happening? The whole country is going to hell, you know. And we have to get back to the way it was when it was great. In other words, get rid of all these things that have changed in a positive way, even though they're limited and they, like I said, they can't really deal with the whole problem. And, you know, they're angry about, the Vietnam War, the line that they've been sold, which they used to peddle back in the day, but it's gotten more out there now that we could have won the war except we were betrayed by the politicians in Washington. See, we really were going to win the war in Vietnam, but the politicians in Washington wouldn't let us. I remember that William Westmoreland, who was one of the big commanders of the U.S. forces in Vietnam at the height of the Vietnam War, came back after they'd lost the war, basically, and made this speech and said, "We were winning the war in Vietnam, but we lost it in Berkeley." Now, having grown up in Berkeley, I was really excited by that. But, you know, that's a great thing, but it wasn't true. You know, I mean, people in Berkeley, sort of using that as a metaphor for all the protests around the country, did play an important role in opposing that war and contributed to the fact that the U.S. couldn't have won it, which it should not have. But it was, you know, the Vietnamese fighting in Vietnam and the whole international situation that was more, you know, the reason that they couldn't win that war. I don't have time to go into all that now. But the point I'm making is that, you know, you see, for a long time, all these veterans of the Vietnam War and, in general, veterans were sort of, you know, they were sort of like felt on the defensive, you know, and they weren't coming around because there was this whole movement of veterans, very good movement, Vietnam veterans against the war, you know. They had this whole thing where they had a demonstration of thousands in Washington, D.C., where they took their medals and threw them away on the steps and the sick. Next time we fight, it'll be to take these steps and so on like this. So now all these, you know, all these veterans who were not coming from a good place, going all the way back to Vietnam, are coming out of the woodwork and they got their veteran, you know, veteran of Vietnam hats. I wanted to get a hat that said veteran really big of opposing imperialist wars. But anyway, this, you know, this, all this kind of stuff. And then there's the whole thing where, you know, there was the Atheists of America who went to the Supreme Court and won a decision in the early 60s that the schools could not promote religion. So now a lot of these people say, well, that's when it, you know, especially the Christian fundamentalists, that's when it all went to hell, is once they took God out of the schools. You know, and now these people, that's another thing you should understand, want to gut public education. Because they don't want public education, because they think public education indoctrinates people in secular humanism. So they don't want that secular humanism, you know. So they want, actually, they regard public schools as an enemy institution that should be destroyed and instead should be replaced by, you know, right now they're doing it with a lot of the, you know, home schooling. But their ultimate goal is basically to get religious schools. So, you know, all this is, if you look at all, you know, all these different elements, this is all what Trump, who originally was not really with all this stuff, He's always been a racist and a misogynist, male chauvinist pig. But he wasn't with all this fascist stuff. But at a certain point, his racism and his male chauvinism pushed him in the direction of these fascist forces, and they sort of had an unholy alliance, where they're all of them are saying, well, all this stuff about him and running around with prostitutes and porn stars or whatever, and Playboy bunnies. That was a different Trump, Now he's become, he's gotten religion, And I actually saw remember that Access Hollywood tape came out, grab him by the, Well, I actually saw one of these women that was always on CNN, so they seem to have an army, if you'll pardon me for saying this, of blonde zombies. And she was one of those on there, and she had her cross on and everything. And when this came out, the Access tape, she says, well, I believe that Trump can be saved. We're all washed in the blood of Jesus. We're all sinners. In other words, basically, never mind that, because he's doing all these fascist things that we want done, including promoting Christian fundamentalism, so we're going to ignore all this stuff. My point being, and to answer your question, I think you can see by all this, this is a very concerted program. All this is the stuff that they're going after. It has to do with knocking down even other ruling class forces and institutions that don't want to go to that in that particular direction, like the media is the enemy of the people and so on and so forth. There's a so-called deep state, the intelligence institutions, including even the CIA and FBI, which are monstrously criminal, but they're not fully under the control of these forces. So they want to basically remake everything to implement this whole program. And then internationally, it's like any kind of agreement that doesn't, that's been made is not good enough, because we have to become even more gangster-like. And whether it's economic agreements or military agreements, we have to become even more gangster-like in pushing our interests. So if you look at all this, people constantly, especially, if you watch MSNBC or CNN or listen to the Democrats, they always want to talk about as if Trump doesn't know what he's doing, or he's about ready to be brought down next Tuesday by Mueller's investigation or whatever. But they act like he's sort of like a joke almost, or like, okay, he's bad, but he's really incompetent. He's not going to be, and he's rolling along with the whole program. Look at all the stuff they're implementing. I mean, this thing that they're doing against immigrants, which is another big thing. See, these people are freaked out about the fact that if the current trends continue, the United States will no longer be a white majority country in population within another decade or so, or maybe two. They're freaked out about that. This country has to have the identity as white, Christian, male-dominated, etc. So, this is the big push behind the anti-immigrant thing. And, a lot, we have to also struggle with people about that. You'll even hear people really oppressed, you'll even hear black people say, oh, these immigrants are taking our jobs. What's taken your job, quote-unquote, is capitalism, not these immigrants, first of all. Second of all, you do not have a job. There is no job that has your name on it. This was bequeathed to me by my grandfather. This job for $8.25 an hour was my inheritance. No, you work or don't work depending on whether the capitalists can make out on exploiting you. And look, after World War I, a lot of black people came up from the South, and the capitalists did the same thing. They said, we can hire these desperately poor black people who've left everything behind in the South, and say white workers are on strike in St. Louis or something. We'll bring in all these black people to work there and then set up this whole thing where the white people will riot against them. And then, look, I'll just say it like this. Here's these white people saying, these black people are taking our jobs. Here's an appeal to black people. You do not want to sound like white people, okay? I mean, really, think about it. You know, yes, look, people, you know what I mean. Look, people are, you know, people are desperate to get jobs and everything. Yes, that's true. But you should be joining with the other people who are being viciously exploited and impoverished the same way you are, instead of being played for suckers by being turned against people who are being exploited even more, which is the same thing they did to you, you know, to your grandparents or great-grandparents when they came from the South, you know. And now, the other side of it is all these people, oh, you know, these black people are lazy. Nobody in the history of this country has ever worked harder than black people, okay? Let's just, you know, not only in slavery, but, you know, 2-3 jobs coming up from the South, you know, being exploited for generations, producing massive wealth, you know, and then getting pushed out because it's more profitable for the capitalists to go somewhere else or to bring in people who are even more desperate and exploit them and turn the oppressed against each other. And we got to struggle, people, to see that this is the nature of the system. This is what it does to people. This is what it's going to keep on doing to people until we get rid of it. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have a decent future for you. I mean, which doesn't mean we shouldn't struggle now. We should. You know, people are poor. People are desperate. They can't raise their kids. You know, they can't, you know, they're working 2-3 jobs trying to, you know, take care of their family and finding it more and more difficult. Of course we should unite with people to struggle against that. You know, and to find a ways that people can, you know, not just survive, but, you know, not see their kids either go without health care or go without food or whatever. But we're not going to get where we need to go if we get people who are in basically fundamentally being messed over by the same system to be fighting each other, whether it's in the youth in the gangs or whether it's people who are fighting for the same job. We got to get people to see the larger picture and the deeper causes of this and then struggle to unite them to fight against the system. I mean, you know, look, something like McDonald's workers, you know, fighting for $15 an hour is not the answer, but it's something that should be supported, you know, because people do have to survive. And we can't just tell people, well, when the revolution comes, we'll solve all this. We have to pay attention to how people are suffering now and to waging struggle, but you have to do it in a way that's consistent with ultimately dealing with the whole problem and not in a way that turns the oppressed against each other. So going back to Trump, though, and all that, all these things are what they're doing. They're doing it right now. It's not just what they will do. They're doing it now. And if you want to know where they will go, listen to them talk, because they're pretty much telling you what they're doing. Listen to Pence, not just Trump. You know, and see what they're actually doing. Look through the fog, you know, penetrate beyond the fog that's being created on the news media to act like these people don't know what they're doing and aren't getting anywhere. They are moving on all these different fronts that I just talked about in a very concentrated way. And, you know, it's getting, the hour is getting later and later to be able to stop this. You know, I've said elsewhere, people need to tell these people who don't, you know, really hate what Trump's about, but they go, oh, well, you know, we'll just wait for the Democratic blue wave or I can't see how taking to the streets would possibly accomplish anything, you know. You know, when right around you in the world, you've had examples of people who forced out governments by taking to the streets, you know, in a number of different countries. And I can't imagine how we could get hundreds of thousands of people in the street. How many times in the last year and a half have you seen hundreds of thousands of people in the streets? It's that you don't want to take that step of putting it on the line to say that this whole regime has to go. And people need to be told that that's morally bankrupt. And second of all, history is not going to look on you very kindly. If when you still had the chance, at least a fighting chance to stop this, you sat on your hands and did nothing. You know, like, I even heard one of these intelligence chiefs, I forget whether it was Hayden or Clapper, one of these people used to head up the National Intelligence or the NSA or whatever, saying, you know, making an analogy to Nazi Germany. And he was asked about it, and he said, well, I wouldn't compare the U.S. today under Trump to Germany in 1942, but I would compare it to Germany in 1933. Now, even a person in the ruling class is saying that. Listen up, all you liberals. You know, here's a person from the ruling class, and what was 1933? That was when Hitler was in power, started moving against all these other forces, but hadn't fully consolidated everything yet. And if people had moved against it then, they might have been able to prevent all the horrors that came afterward, including the, you know, the killing of the 6 million Jews in the concentration camps and everything else. Well, right now, you are in a position that's similar to Germany in 1933. And if you don't move to do something about it, then that whatever comes from that, which is not going to be good, it's going to be disastrous at least, and catastrophic possibly, that's on you too. Because, and I'm not just ranting here, I'm saying people need to be brought up against this. You know, that's on you too if you don't act now when you could have a chance to actually prevent all these horrors that you know somewhere are coming. You know, and get rid of your illusions that somehow the Democratic Party is going to do this or Mueller is going to do it. None of that's going to do anything in the absence of millions of people in the streets demanding that this whole thing has to go.
All right, welcome back. That was part of the program. That was actually a part of the question and answer period that followed a speech that was given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And that presentation was why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. And you can access that full speech as well as all the parts from the Q&A discussion that followed by going to revcom.us. Now, we're going to be joined by Andy Z. Andy's a regular guest on this show, and I was really pleased to have him back on it this time because there's a lot to talk about. Andy's a spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York, and he's also the co-initiator of Refused Fascism. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into it, man. There's a hell of a lot to talk about. Let's start by giving people an overview of where are things at today, man? What's being called for and what needs to be done in a just sort of a broad sense?
Okay, well, Refused Fascism is calling for protests on the day after the election and then again on Saturday. But look, let's take a quick look at this last week. And if this last week, Michael, doesn't tell your listeners that this regime is fascist and that they are rapidly bringing a fascist America that's going to imperil all of humanity, then I don't know what will. Maybe people who are listening to this who feel that way should just turn the dial and switch to an easy listening station. But if you've got your eyes open, your ears open, and if you're thinking about it, you have to face the fact that the world as we have known it is rapidly being torn asunder by the very workings of the system that we live under, capitalism, imperialism. This is a system that exploits and oppresses people here and around the world, and Bob Avakian just brought a lot of that to the listeners in that answer to a question as part of his speech on why we need a revolution, how we could really make a revolution. But this system is encountering very sharp and serious challenges here and around the world, as he's brought forward in a different film, The Trump-Pence Must Go. Fascism is one possible resolution from the perspective of those people who run the system to the problems they face. But it's a resolution that's on the terms of this system and the ruling class, even as this creates a great horror for humanity. So I think we need to get into this more deeply, and if you will, I could speak a little more about it now, or we could talk a bit about it.
No, go ahead and speak a little bit more about it now.
Okay, I will. I mean, look, Avakian just went into, in answer to the question, well, if they consolidate their rule, what is it going to look like? And he said, well, just look at what they're already doing. He brought this out very trenchantly. I won't repeat what he said about white supremacy, xenophobia, what's happening to the immigrants, the whole gamut that he spoke about. But let's just, again, look at the last week. There's been the largest mass slaughter of 11 Jewish people in worship. The anti-Semitism that's behind that, which is closely linked to the white supremacy that's been in the history of this country. And look, these people are, if you listen to Fox TV, let alone the even more far-right fascist stations, this is being fomented over and over again, barely with a dog whistle. And Trump himself is actually not apologizing and backing down, but actually doubling down. Now, look, right before this, we had pipe bombs that were mailed to leaders of the Democratic Party or people who represent and speak for them in the media. And let's be really clear on this. That should tell people that there's a big struggle up at the top of society between two sections of society, two sections of the ruling class, the Democrats on the one hand and the Republicans on the other, both who preside over the system, but that there is, in order for these fascists to bring about their program, which is within the confines of this system, radically different, and it's going to mean tremendous suffering for people here and around the world, an intensification of the things that have gone on before, but at the same time, in a way that essentially strips away the governing norms of society, separation of church and state, the rule of law, the separation of powers, all these things, you can see them being torn asunder and increasing the threat of war, a more bellicose foreign policy. Now, then comes the caravan, which Trump has been just demonizing with, yes, a lot of falsehoods, but it's a falsehood that creates a narrative that a section of people are working on and actually speaks to some very fundamental things. Look, back again to the fact that the Democrats are not going to put up any kind of meaningful resistance to that. And they just listen to what they said that they will do if they win. And I want to just back up here for a second. The protest that we're calling for, we being refused fascism, it says no matter if you vote, no matter who wins, in the name of humanity, we have to drive out the regime. But the Democrats have told you that if they win, they want to show that they are a party that wants to govern and that this is why they're going to cooperate with the Trump-Pence regime and not investigate. This is why they don't want to touch the immigration issue right now. They say, oh, the issue should be health care. Of course, health care is important, but they don't want to touch this tremendous crime against humanity that's going on. Look, the former head of the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania, who was also the governor of Pennsylvania and actually did a lot to see to work towards the execution, which was eventually prevented, of Mumia Abu-Jamal, Ed Rendell, just said this past week, he said, look, what I would do if I got in power is I would make a deal with Trump and give him his money for the wall and see if I could get a deal on immigration in exchange for the wall. This is what a leader of the Democratic Party is saying. But what kind of deal would that be? Let's take a look at what would Donald Trump's white supremacist, xenophobic beliefs and policies actually mean for around immigration? What kind of deal would he sign? Let alone, what about this whole section of the country that numbers in the tens of millions of people? What would they actually be willing to settle for? How would they be unleashed if he sold them out? Look, I think let me come back to this. But then also, more fundamentally, what about the Democrats and what kind of deal would they want to make? We cannot forget that President Obama was known as a deporter in chief. Look, the system of capitalism, imperialism, and the United States has ravaged the countries from which refugees and immigrants come. It's the system that has brought 65 million refugees wandering the planet looking for a way to live and survive over the last year. And there comes a point for the Democrats where, if you want to call it this, the public relations, the optics of things are trumped by, yes, and I use the pun deliberately, are trumped by the actual interest and necessity that they face, because they can't open the border in the way that it should be. I saw somebody on Facebook was saying, well, boy, I'm really getting feel upset watching these immigrants try to march here all the way from Honduras, right? Why don't we go down and pick them up? Well, you may want to do that, and that'd be a good idea. Actually, why don't the Democratic Party mobilize the masses of people to come down here? Because they can't, because they actually are a ruling class party. You know, and maybe we can talk a little bit more, but the direct cause, actually, of this, what's going on with the two-thirds of these people on the caravan are from Honduras. Honduras, a country that in 2009 was a coup d'etat that brought a more fascist regime to power, a coup that was known ahead of time by, and as I understand it, and definitely supported by Hillary Clinton, who was then the Secretary of State, and Barack Obama. And this has created, without going into all of it now, tremendous fascistic horror and a murderous regime that has caused these people to leave their country. Yes, made in the USA and now coming to the USA and to be met by guns of federal troops who Trump yesterday said, I'm going to tell them if the immigrants throw stones that they should be shot. So here again, you know, my point is that the Democrat Party have told you, and the Washington Post has told the New York Times, that they're going to work with this regime. So we have to actually, we can get into this more in the conversation of why they won't mobilize their social base and why they are trying to channel you into supporting them through the normal channels of election. And as soon as the election's over, besides working with the Republicans and the fascist regime, they're going to actually say, well, now you have to work for 2020. Can you imagine where this regime is going to be by then? And my third point here on what we can learn from this week is that there is a way out of the madness. Fundamentally, and in the final analysis, what we must be working for today, and what I as a spokesperson of Revolution Books believe, and what the speech that Bob Avakian gave, of which you took an answer and broadcast it before I began speaking, was that we have to overthrow the system that's given rise to this fascism, and where all the things that this fascist regime is doing in a more extreme form that Avakian brought out in that clip, the white supremacy, the attacks on immigrants, the attacks on the environment, the misogyny, the danger of war, all of this is going to be greatly intensified. But we need to prepare today for a revolution that we can make when the time and the conditions are right for that. But whether or not your listeners agree that we need a whole new system and or if they see revolution as the way to bring that into being, there's no good future for anybody who has any concern for humanity and for the future of the planet and the other species that live on this planet that doesn't require you right now acting outside the normal channels of political life in this country, breaking your normal routine. Because it is being broken already. And the question is, are you going to just sit on your ass? Then I do say, go listen to an easy listening station. Or are you just going to go pull a lever on Tuesday or not pull a lever on Tuesday because you think it's all the same stuff that's going on? Are you going to get out and get into the streets and start building the kind of movement where very soon, within the next few months, we can actually get to the point where millions of people take to the streets day after day, night after night, create the kind of political crisis in this country where those in power, yes, in the Democratic Party, perhaps those in the Republican Party who've been under fire, the very few who are still left, will then decide to actually do something to remove this entire regime from power. But then, of course, in that situation, the struggle will still be on, but we'll be in better conditions with an aroused people who are fighting in their interests, and we can go forward from there. So that's some of what I wanted to say about why people should get out into the streets and represent with Refuse Fascism on Wednesday in cities across the country, and then on Saturday in even greater numbers. So whether you voted or didn't vote, and whoever wins, this fascist regime is still going to be in power, and in the name of humanity, they need to go. And the answer to how they go rests with you, the listeners of this station, and millions of other people getting out in the streets and putting something on the line. As Avakian said, history will not look kindly on you if you fail to act.
Now, we have about maybe 5 or 6 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you this because I think it feeds into some of what you were already talking about. But this whole idea, you know, there's a thing that goes, that it just comes out all over the society, in this country in particular, about, look, America is America. You know, American fascism, it can't happen here. I had somebody sit there and tell me, no, you know, there's too much that we have already embedded in our thinking and in the way the system works, all these things of having, you know, there's a way out of this. There's a way of mobilizing people. They talk about the question of elections and all this. And I recently came across something from Refuse Fascism that I think people need to consider, and you started to speak to, but people need to really consider this and wrestle with it, that fascism can come to power through normal processes of elections and laws. And that's actually true. It can. It's not like it doesn't have to be a coup. Donald Trump didn't necessarily actually take part in a coup, or at least an open coup, but it can't be removed from power that way, which is something I think people really have to wrestle with. What is it going to take to actually stand up and do what you're talking about?
Well, I think that's an important point. Look, fascism actually very often comes to power through elections. It's happening all over the world. It just happened in Brazil. It's a foolish statement. And look, I have to say that, assuming that's the that statement that the people you were arguing with know something about history. They're just deliberately ignoring and acting ignorant in that kind of way, or they've got such blinders on by the effect of whatever comfort they have in their life that they're not facing up to the reality. How could fascism come about in a country that was founded on slavery and white supremacy? That's really a mystery to me, and that has continued that white supremacy all through its history. How could a country that was founded on such deep patriarchal misogyny that has continued all through its history, including, Avakian, you just brought out a point in your clip there about it's only been in the last several decades that even the right to rape your wife was taken away in the last of the states. How could a country that was founded on the American exceptionalism and invading countries over and fomenting coups and all around the world, how could a country like that be fascist? Come on, fascism coming to America wrapped in the American flag with the Christian fundamentalists, that political form of that, the Christian fascists headed up by Mike Pence. So it's fusing that, trying to make this a white Christian nation that protects the rights of men, and that this is what's going on. And you're not going to get that to change by relying on the party that is being targeted by this regime, but at the same time represents that same system and has those interests in mind and will not actually unleash people at the bottom of society or people who are oppressed by this. Because I think once people raise their heads and start really fighting sincerely against the institutions and the culture that reinforce this white supremacy and misogyny, and who, look, just take the environment that there was the Paris Accord, which was not going to solve the problem of the environment. That it requires mobilizing all of society to go on the offensive to prevent the release of carbon into the atmosphere. The Democrats aren't going to do that. This is why the only way to change this is to mobilize the masses of people. And as Avakian brought out, first off, it's been done, and it's been done recently in countries around the world, from Armenia to South Korea. There was the Arab Spring. Yes, it got turned around, but that's just because people didn't understand what they were actually fully up against. And that question will come here. But we have to actually recognize that that has been done. People say, well, you can't get American people to step out of their homes. Well, millions of people have demonstrated in the last year. But the problem is they've been doing so in only a symbolic way and only for a day. And every time they start to want to protest, the Democratic Party and its people in the so-called progressive movements of this country channel people back into the elections, which leaves the people without a way to really fight and put forward their own interests. Nothing changes without struggle. Every change that's come about in this country, every reform that's come about in this country has come from struggle. And if you don't maintain that struggle, guess what happens? You get where we are today, where the very reforms won in the 60s are being taken away, and the reforms themselves have fueled and undergirded this fascist movement who wants to revert back even further into the past.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andy, we're going to have to wrap this up now, but we're going to have you back again soon to continue talking about this, because this is clearly the question of our times. How the hell are we going to deal with all this? How are we going to come up out of this? And how are we going to change the world in a way that humanity can actually live like human beings? All right, so...
Okay. Well, thank you, Michael. And I just hope all your audience did not tune out to the Easy Listening Station, but actually tuned in and gets out in the streets on Wednesday and then on Saturday. And you can go to refusefascism.org to find out where the demonstration is around the country for those who are listening on the Internet. It's happening in several cities.
All right. Thanks a lot, Andy. Talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Here we are, like we're gonna get war again. Coming hard, come and get a gun, join the gang. With the bang bang in the same song we sang.
All right, that was the Balkan Beatbox with War Again. Next up, we're going to be talking with Oliver Mayer, the author of the play Members Only. And as I do from time to time on this show, I'm presenting a discussion of a play that you may not be able to see in your area. But I think you'll enjoy the conversation I had with Oliver and get a lot out of it. You're going to be thinking pretty hard and fast. Right now, I'm really pleased to be welcoming somebody to the show who I went to see a play the other night, and I was sitting there and basically watching and saying, who the hell did this play? it was one of these plays that actually just grabbed me. It just grabbed me and held on to me for the entire time. And I was really pleased to be able to bring to the show Oliver Mayer. And I'm pronouncing that right?
Perfectly.
Okay. And Oliver is the writer of the play. And so you gave birth to that, right?
Yes, I did. gosh, it feels really good.
Tell people what it's about first, actually.
Sure. I wrote a play in the 90s called Blade to the Heat, which was a life changer for me. And I think really a lot of people remember. I'm really glad about that. It had a dynamism to it that just was a little bit different from other plays. And it dealt with sexual behavior, sexual identity in the world of boxing, which a lot of people hadn't thought about. Because, I don't know, there isn't a lot of difference, you know, at least publicly, everything is the same. They're all male, they're all tough, they're all strong. And so I looked at difference in that world, and I set the play in an extreme moment in the 50s when Liberace was straight. You know, whatever Liberace was, he could be nothing other than straight.
Yeah.
And so my professional fighter, my world champion, my Chicano, who makes it to the big time in New York, Pete Quinn, becomes champion and then suffers over an outing. There's another fighter who outs him, and it leads to tragedy. So 22 years later, here we are with Members Only. And 22 years later in my life, I revisit my surviving characters. So the people in their mid-20s are now approaching 50, and they've made their separate ways. And Quinn, the former world champion, is still fighting at that age, which is a very dangerous thing to do. And Quinn, who had been so marked by being other than straight in the 50s, in the early 80s in New York, can live what we would call a gay lifestyle. That doesn't mean he's out, but it does mean that he has a life. And there's a new generation of people who look a lot like we do in 2018, who have a lot of opportunity to be themselves, whatever that may be, not binary, and can try lots of new stuff. There's a woman who wants to fight, and that was a big deal in the 80s. The thing that no one realizes is that they're standing on the edge of a precipice, and the AIDS virus has not been named yet, but is beginning to take people. And that is part of this play as well.
And there's so much. I mean, that precipice is actually it's long, if not wide, but it's really long in terms of the kind of thing that you have there where, I read where you boxed when you were a kid.
I did.
And I did too. And
oh, cool.
That's
what happened to our faces.
Right. Faces and brain. You got a little bit of a tilted brain after that. But it was sort of, it's interesting because when I saw that, what you brought to the stage in this, and I saw the original play as well, and what you brought to the stage in all this was, it wasn't the kind of thing, even when having boxed, I didn't look at myself as even like a human when I was boxing. You were somebody who was going, you were going into fight and you were going into win. And what you did with this was so important in terms of, yes, all the things that you're talking about, this guy who's gay and doesn't want to put it out, and there's all this stuff going on in the world, but there's also this thing of, he's somebody who clearly cares about the world and about other people. And, it's just, and so he's sitting in there, and it's such a step back from what people normally think of in terms of boxing and the whole fight scene. And I thought that was really, it was really important because you then began to peel away all these layers and dig into the actual human experience of these people that were in the play, which I thought was really, really important.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah, it's my intention. I think we look at celebrity, we look at athletes, and we see what they do. And we forget that they're like we are. And we forget they have politics. And boy, we forget they have personal lives that they would protect above all things if they could. I like to say that Quinn in this play is a lonely warrior. He did not necessarily want any of the fights beyond the fight game that he has to pick up to protect this young woman from the bullying and the gym and the harassment and worse that could happen to her. That's part of this play. Much less all of this mantle around homosexuality. It's the last thing he wants. And yet he's all alone and no one else is going to do the fight. And so, and actually, this is a fiction. In the 80s, there was nobody like Pete Quinn. I had to invent it. That's kind of sad.
Wow, yeah. Wow, that's amazing. One thing I wanted to ask you before we get really deeper into the whole thing.
Let's
is
do it.
Actually the way it was staged. I had to ask you about this because there's that sort of that almost like Egyptian or, you know, whatever it is, this kind of movement of the people when they're walking across the stage and when they're going off the stage and coming onto the stage, this whole grouping of people that actually brought you to a whole different place because you're watching this and you're thinking, wait a minute, what the hell is this? Where's it coming from? But it was really, you know, I kept watching and I kept thinking, and eventually I was like, this is really cool. This is really bringing something. And I wasn't quite sure what it was bringing to it, but it was actually, in terms of the atmosphere and what was going on, it was very heavy to see this very ordered march. And in the midst of this, like, actually, you know, as we both know, boxing can be a very brutal and ruthless and, you know, and doesn't, even when you have rules, the rules often bend quite easily. So, and, but then you're seeing this movement, this dance movement as people go on and off the stage. I was really, really intrigued by that.
Our mutual friend, Jose Luis Valenzuela, that is his brilliance. And the Latino Theater Company that he's been with for 30 years has found a kind of a language, a gestural language, and that's part of it. We put this play up pretty fast, and I will admit that, I don't know, 10 days in, we took a whole rehearsal to just kind of find our physical life, our gestures, and I'm like, oh, man, we don't got enough time for this. But I knew. I didn't say anything because I knew how important it would be. We listened to music. We found it in our bodies. We realized that I know this from a long career, that I write a lot of scenes that hopefully add up to something, but the transitions between them, the cartilage that joins them, is as or more important. And that was all Valenzuela, so you got a really good friend there.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it puts you into the middle of something that you don't really expect to be in the middle of.
Well, we should probably say the play is set in 1982, mm-hmm. And if people remember the 80s, the music of the 80s is all around us on when we're in the stuck in traffic and all that FM radio. But, you know, it was pretty awful, a lot of it. But I think I found a couple of really good cuts that really give us a sense of maybe how it might have felt. I deal with a little bit of Laurie Anderson, mm-hmm. Willie Colon, and the Fania salsa, and also the Death of Disco with Donna Summer, which is, disco never dies.
I have mixed feelings about that. But I was really impressed by the music. I thought that actually brought something big to it. And also the young woman that you had in the play, she was a remarkable character. I mean, it was, and because she is going through all of the things that the guy who's actually the protagonist in the play. You're looking at this and it's sort of, I don't know. I mean, it got me because it's sort of, she wants to be a boxer.
Yeah.
But she doesn't want all the bull that goes with it, and she doesn't, and she's, but she's not going to give in to any of that. But she's gonna stand her ground. But the person who actually brings her forward is somebody who boxes and boxed and loved it, but also hated it at the same time in a certain way. But it was, and I thought the relationship between the two of them was really, really interesting.
He sees a kindred spirit. In the first play, he was shunned by the boxing community, and actually they wished him ill. And here he is coming into a gym and seeing a woman all alone without anyone to protect her. And really in a great deal of danger. And as you say, kind of not giving any quarter. And he realizes that he has something to do. In a certain way, she's like a daughter to him. And he protects her as long as he can. You've seen the play, so you know that stuff comes up that makes it very difficult to keep protecting her. And in the end, we know this, whether we're our brother or sister's keeper. You know, it's sometimes it's a little up in the air. We do the darndest we can to try to help each other, but sometimes the world intervenes.
What about the other woman in the play?
Well, that's my wife, Marlene Forte.
I was just going to give you a little chance there.
So funnily enough, when I wrote the first play, Marlene was starting out her career in New York, and she's, of course, had a fabulous TV and film career, wonderful stage actress, but she couldn't get seen for Blade. So when we got married, she kind of whispered in my ear more than once. She said, look, I want to play that part, but I'm getting too old. And so I figured, well, if I write this maybe a sequel, then maybe she could play the part. And then once I realized I needed, if I were going to write her part, I'd have to write everybody's parts. And this has been the process about 7 or 8 years to just, you use the word layering. They're layers of time, you know, like igneous rock, like makeup. It's just one under another. And or like, you know, maybe kind of like a painter might do. And that's how you get texture. And that's how you maybe begin to understand how time really works.
There's another thing in the play that gets to me too, which is the basically, and I was thinking about this for a while because There's so much heart in it, in all the characters in the series, even the ones that you sort of detest. You know, it's sort of, there's a lot of heart. The bad people are full of heart when they're being bad. And the people who are, you know, just searching for a way, you know, just a way to have some kind of more than a passing connection with other human beings. And that point about this sort of the idea that there's, you know, the problem and the joy of having too much heart, which I think is really important in relation to all that.
So. Thanks, Michael. It comes up early in the play that it's a question of heart. It's a question of feeling. And this main character, Quinn, the reason that he deserves a second play and maybe a third before I check out of this planet is that he does have so much feeling for his fellow man despite getting beat on, and not just in the ring. You and I both know that there are worse things than getting punched. That's the best thing about fighting is he's like, I can take it. You know, of course, there are a couple of blows. You know, you feel them particularly to the body later. But I've been far hurt worse outside of the ring, and so is Quinn.
And hurt even in terms of when you think about this, the hurt, the emotional hurt that actually people – it's astounding because this is one thing you bring through the entire play is the emotional pain that people go through. And no matter what they're doing in their life, there's always – and all of the characters have some form and a deep form of emotional pain that both sets them in motion but also as part of their basic humanity as well.
I think the audience understands that. And I mean, I have a lot of joy in my life, and I hope people listening do too. But we know it's really hard out there, and people categorize us constantly, you know, whether it's on our darn phones, you know, we go buy something and they tell us what we think we should buy or that this is fun, pressing buttons or whatever it might be, that we're being categorized, we're being tribalized, and it's out of our hands a lot of times unless we take it back. And so hopefully plays like this remind people, check people to kind of remember who their family really is. And maybe even to get in a dark room with people they don't agree with, but to come out of it and realize they went through something together, even if they don't agree. I think I don't know how you feel about this, but I like to write plays where there's not one way to take it, where there's a lot of ways to take it. I don't know how you were with your wife when you left the theater, but I feel like you probably had something to talk about. You mostly agreed, but I bet you saw different things. That's my intention.
No, we agree with everything. All the time, always yes, of course.
As long as you liked it, I'm happy.
We agreed on really liking it. But it's interesting because there is this, I mean, look, I don't know. I was just thinking about this thing. I'm looking at these, you know, things I had written down that I wanted to ask you. But it's actually, there's so much to think about in relation to this play. And, you know, you said that actually in a way that the time was right for this play.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. But the time was right for the other play, the earlier play, the version too. And it's sort of, you're following along this trail. And I think when you have that divide that developed in the 80s, because it was a very real question that came up. And it really got to me that, one, your character, your lead character is gay and can't tell anybody. And there's all this stuff about, you know, what happens because of that. But it's still, it's like this, you have this, you're going into this situation where it is, the time is right. There's time is right for all this. And I'll tell you, it's interesting because I had also worked in VD clinics in the Bronx years and years ago. And, you know, I would see the kinds of things that people, and then I worked in the big gay neighborhood in Manhattan. I can't remember what.
West Village, or
yeah, no, it's a little. Anyway, it was West Village, but it was another area. But it was very heavy because people would come in even there, and there was a real pullback of like, I'm not going to get stomped on and hurt because I'm gay because of who I am. But it was also, they would say things like, you know, but I am right. Gay, and I'm not going to give up my humanity. And I thought that was one of the things that really comes out in your play, especially. You know, as it develops, and I won't say anything more except that it does come to the fore, the demand that I'm a human being and I demand to be treated as such, you know?
I think that's dead on. I think sexual identity, it's not the only identifier. Obviously, color, ethnicity, race, racial language, all kinds of things help identify us. But I think our sexuality is a big identifier, and it really belongs to us. Mm-hmm. So those people that you met back in the day, God help them. I hope they're still with us, at least some of them. Hopefully they were just taking control of something that they could still grab hold of. Because, you know, we know we can't necessarily affect Washington unless we really, really work for it. Mm-hmm. The economy is often very much against us. But at least we have the choice of who we want to be with and how we want to show our love. But we know it's really dangerous. And that's the thing that AIDS taught us, because it was a moment, I was pretty young as it was beginning, but it was a moment where people were feeling rather free and liberated and feeling, I don't know, even artistic about their lovemaking. And it put the kibosh on it real fast. Mm-hmm. And I believe we're in a moment that, if we don't watch out, could be like that. I hope not. But we know that particularly among Black and brown communities, AIDS is back.
Yeah. It's also, I don't know, you know, it got to me because there's also, look, we still, to this day, we still have this massive, even though we have so much more, you know, supposedly so much more understanding, so much more open-minded, but there's still, you know, gay people still get killed for who they love. You know, and AIDS is still seen as like, you know, it's the gay disease, you know, and it's sort of all of these things that, and you put that in conjunction with the monster that we have running the country right now, you know, and what that could mean for all people, and especially for the people that you're writing about, which I thought that also brought it home to me in a big way, the importance of, and you know, you, and I won't say anything because you haven't, not only have you not finished the you made it a trilogy. I'm going to make you stick to that.
I'm going to have to stick to it. Yeah. I'll have to come back on here in a few years and talk about the third play.
Definitely. We'll have you back before that. So I enjoy talking with you. So you're back for one way or another. But you have all of this going on, and it all can, you know, and there's a couple points in the play where you see that this all can either go forward or it can crumble into some very bad things, you know. And that was some of the dynamic that I thought that was really important here. And we have about a minute for you to say something about that.
Well, I think we're all on a tightrope. I mean, the people listening to us, and what I tell everyone out there is don't look up and don't look down. Just keep walking.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But, yeah, the vertigo is real, and the danger is real. Your show is about it. Whenever you're on the air, you're talking about it in one way or another. And it's up to me as an artist in this city, a committed artist from Los Angeles, to try to put the mirror up. And the way I deal with it, at least with these two plays, is I give us a little sense of history. But I really do it so that we can look at our own moment and try not to make those mistakes.
And you leave it with the door cracked open for the future as well, which I thought is really important too, because you don't know where things are going to go at that point, you know. And I really enjoyed that. I really thought that was important.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, we are out of time, but we're going to have you back, man. I want to let people know that the play is, we've been talking with Oliver Mayer, and the play is Members Only. I want to thank you very much for joining us, man.
Thanks, Michael.
All right, take care. That brings us to the end of yet another show. I'd like to thank my guests and all the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and engineer, Gary Baca, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. That's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Let's Make History by the International Noise Conspiracy. Talk to you again next week.